Russ Lopez, I'm an assistant professor of environmental health at the School of Public Health. I've been involved in environmental justice issues for almost, maybe even more than 15 years, and I've been blessed by the fact that I get to work with people of passion, but then cursed because I always have to follow them up. So I'm not going to be quite as dynamic. I'm probably the nerd of the movement, so I apologize for that. I'm going to actually talk about methods. I guess there's two things you can do when you see these things, these kinds of disparities. One is you can, well, certainly you should get mad, because I think these are things you should get angry about. But you can either get depressed and sit there, or you can think, you know, I'm going to do something. And my small contribution is in statistical analysis, which may not be as passionate, but certainly, hopefully, will give people a little ammunition as they go through these things. Uh-oh. Where'd it go?
Oh, yes. Oh.
As you've seen, health status is not simply what you do. And it's important that we remember that we live in a society that wants to individualize everything. And that's not true. People are in communities, they're in neighborhoods, they're in society as a whole. And that broader context is as much a driver of health as anything that the individual does. And even a lot of factors that people like to say or blame or throw on the individual, one might think about alcohol behaviors or smoking behaviors, aren't necessarily set by individuals. They're set by what goes on in the community in which individuals live. So you really have to look at these broader than individual factors if you really want to understand the whole context of people's health. In addition, certain things really can't be measured on the individual level. They have no meaning. For example, racial residential segregation has no meaning. If I were to pick one of you randomly out of this room, I cannot say anything just by measuring you about your segregation level. It has no context. Certain things like segregation only have meaning, can only be defined, can only be really studied in a societal context. So segregation has to be measured at something broader than the individual. One data point has no meaning, has no segregation meaning. So you have to look beyond the individual and all these things. The other thing is that certainly people who live in certain areas share certain common exposures, certain common experiences, certain common assumptions, and that also has a meaning and bearing on health. And finally, from my work, and I think what you've seen earlier today, and certainly you probably know from other things, is that this broader social context really has to be more accurately pinned down if we're ever going to actually solve these issues, because we can't solve issues that are caused by broader social conditions by focusing on individuals. That's just not going to work. So in multi-level analysis, is what I do a lot of, it's very important to think about the different levels of action. And remember, think of your own lives, think of how you live and your friends live and your families live. You really move in different realms. So certainly there are individual characteristics we can't change. You're all of a certain age, and even though race and ethnicity are social constructs, it's really pretty impossible to change that. You can change your neighborhood, but certainly individual factors you really sort of are born with. But then there's neighborhood, and we're all shaped by our neighborhoods, whether we want to be or not. And it's, even though we move, about 20-25% of the U.S. population moves every year, to a certain extent, where you live is constrained, where you live sets the context for your behaviors. Similarly, metropolitan area, the city you live in, also sets certain factors. When you saw Dr. Wilson's thing about, what's it called, ETF?
ETJ.
ETJ. I mean, that's something I've never heard of. So, you know, but that's a context that's set by either by the state. Mm-hmm. But it's broader. I mean, so where I live in Massachusetts or where I grew up in California, you don't have that kind of extraterrestrial. It does sound kind of extraterrestrial.
Extraterrestrial, too.
Yeah. It does sound like somebody from outer space might have put that in there. But anyway, but that sets a context. And legal context and social context has an influence on health. And so therefore, you've got to look beyond the individual again. And because you can do that, you can look at what are the health impacts of those kinds of beyond the individual things. Similarly, we all live in the United States, or most of us live in the United States. And again, the country's context, as we've all known for the last 8 years, really can set a great influence on health.
Yep.
Hard for me to keep the election out of it. I do hope you all vote, if you haven't yet. What's that?
I said landslide.
Landslide.
No. You got to vote first.
Anyway, certainly neighborhood health factors have a tremendous impact on health. Nancy Krieger's work and other people's work have really demonstrated that we have these different constructs that go on in neighborhoods. And these are just some of the ways you can sort of think about neighborhood health factors. Disorder, people, most of you I hope have heard about the broken windows theory. I have a few problems with that because it seems to blame individuals for what's going on in their neighborhood as opposed to, let's say, government services. But certainly we now know that there's evidence that just what your physical attractiveness and the amount of vacant land, vacant buildings, those kinds of things that sort of symbolize disorder really do have an impact on health. Similarly, poverty, deprivation has an impact on health. And again, these things are broader than the individual and not necessarily the individual's fault. I mean, certainly the fact that we have poor people who are disproportionately put into certain neighborhoods is not the individual's idea of how they want to live. We have a society that sort of results in these kinds of things. Walkability refers to whether or not you have sidewalks, how much traffic you have, whether it's safe for walking. And certainly, I think most importantly, that a lot of these things indicate is government services. Whether or not you have a fully functional, fully financed, fully representational government that actually provides the basic human rights and services that people deserve to have. These are some of the other factors that you might want to study and certainly have an impact on environmental justice issues and health issues. Urban sprawl refers to a generalized pattern of development, whether or not you have a strong center city, whether or not you have public transportation, whether or not you have high density or low density. Racial residential segregation is the distribution of people by racial or ethnic group across the metropolitan area. Income inequality has also been found to be related to health. That refers to the degree to which income and also related wealth is concentrated among a few people, or whether or not everybody gets to share in the wonderful blessings that this country can offer. And again, government policies that really do set the context. One of the things I strongly believe that most of the environmental inequities in this country are permitted by their state and local governments. Certainly there are lots and lots of unpermitted ones, but even if we got rid of all the illegal things, just the legal activities in this country in and of themselves would be driving environmental inequities. So when you want to study these kinds of factors, you're always limited by data. And on one hand, you should not be limited by data. You should not let your data drive your studies. But on the other hand, the reality is that if you can't measure, if you can't throw it into a regression analysis, you can't throw it into a study if the data don't exist. One of the most common things that people want to include in studies that they oftentimes can't is like crime data, for example. It's a wonderful, you can imagine all the different ways crime, fear of crime, might drive behavior. Whether or not our senior citizens feel safe going to a grocery store, whether or not anybody feels safe playing in a local park. Because if you can't go into a park because it's unsafe, you might as well not have a park. But, it's hard to use crime data, for example, because there is no good national or even statewide data set on crime. Cities and towns tend to report it differently. Jurisdictions report it differently. Oftentimes, you don't get it on a local level. Putting all that aside, it would still be great to have. Another big issue in multi-level modeling is whether or not you're gathering data from subjects themselves or whether or not you're taking it from some kind of independent source. And there's been a lot of looking at that, but no one has quite resolved whether or not it's, which is, whether they're equivalent, was one better, one is not so good. A lot of this comes from the physical activity literature, where people want to look to see whether or not a place is walkable. It's hard to come up with good independent data of whether or not a community is walkable, because until you've walked down that street, how do you know what the street is really like? On the other hand, how do you know that subjects don't walk because they don't feel like walking, and then they rationalize that they don't want to walk? So they say, well, people who could walk, for example, they say, well, you know, the sidewalks aren't any good. So you don't know what comes first, the behavior or the feelings about it. All these things mess up, or I shouldn't say that, can affect the results and can affect the ability to parse out looking at environmental factors when you're trying to do multi-level modeling, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I encourage you all to try doing it. It nowadays is becoming so easy, which is why it's so easy to become abused, like any other statistical package. But there are, you know, most statistical packages now allow you to do it more or less. And what's great is that it allows us to get beyond blaming individuals. It allows us to parse out who's responsible for the variation. Is it inside you? Is it inside each individual subject in your study? Or is it some broader context and some broader level? It also allows those of you who are data nerds, statistical nerds like myself, a way to control for things like the idea that the sample's clustered and that there's other statistical problems that arise if you don't really look at people in their true context and you're trying to make inference on one level based upon data from another level. You have a question, Devin? Oh. Devin Payne Sturges, you know, drives all of our work. And so, you know, if she has a question, I'm like, oh, my God, I freeze. I said something wrong. One of the things in multi-level modeling, and again, I apologize, happy to come after the passion here, to be the one who talks about the methods here, is that it really must be driven by theoretical models of effect. You can't just say, ooh, I have data, I can do something here. You have to have some kind of beginnings of a theory. And so that's why when you see the models that people put up, they're so important. They have to really be the way you put out your data. And the other important thing, and again, this comes from Nancy Krieger's work, is that these levels are not hierarchical. It's not like first you have individual data, then you have neighborhood data, then you have metropolitan level. They're not ordinal. It's not one, two, three. It's not that one is better than the other. It's not that one comes first over the other. They all just exist. So you exist in your neighborhood, and it's not like, well, I guess maybe you are more important than your neighborhood, but in a certain moral sense. But in a statistical sense, there's you, there's a neighborhood. The two just exist side by side. And it's important not to sort of say, this is the more important one than this one. They're both important. Of course, that always brings up a really big question is, what is a neighborhood? And what Sacoby doesn't know is that his collaborator, Omega Wilson, and I have been fighting over how do you come up with a neighborhood, what is the definition of a neighborhood for the last, I think, year now. Because there is no national definition. And there's no great way. I mean, if you wanted to look at the West End neighborhood, for example, my first reaction is to use a census tract because it's easy. Because it's there, somebody else defined it, all the data from the census are reported by census tract. Doesn't help when you're talking about a community of only, let's say, 100 houses, because there just aren't enough people to make up a census tract, so the Census Bureau throws in a lot of these little communities together. On the other side, you could live in a neighborhood, West Harlem, my neighborhood, the South End in Boston, which is made up of multiple census tracts. It's one, any given one census tract, typically sized around 4,000 people, just doesn't, the neighborhood is too big. So, you know, when you have a neighborhood of 30, 40, 50, 100,000 people, you need multiple census tracts to make up that neighborhood. So in some places they're too small, some places they're too large. There's just no great way of using these kinds of things. But of course we all do because we really don't have any really good alternative. And even how people think of their neighborhoods varies. I think of your own experience, how you might think of your neighborhood varies according to the issue. If you're talking about the schools, it might be the distance between you and the closest elementary school. If you're talking about how you, entertainment, on a Saturday night, on a weekend, it might be much broader, all the places you might go. In terms of food environment, it might be a different size. So not only does it change by place, it also changes by issue. It also changes over time. You might think of what a six-year-old might think of his or her neighborhood versus what a 30-year-old might think of their neighborhood versus what a senior citizen might think of their neighborhood. Probably also changes over time. So that makes it much more difficult to figure out what one is. So researchers in general have used zip codes, census tracts, and block groups. And they're obviously not all appropriate. I've used them all. Again, because even though I'm going to tell you all you shouldn't be driven by data, I'm driven by data. So, for example, when I wanted to look at the impacts of having supermarkets in your zip code, in your neighborhood, and I wanted to see what was the impact of that on obesity, the only way you could do it, given the data I had, I was using the data source of the county business patterns that's put out by the census, an annual census of business and industry, it's done by zip code. And in Massachusetts, we found that the smallest zip code was about, were single buildings that didn't have any people in them, but also they were apartment complexes of around 4 to 10 acres, and the largest zip code was around 60 miles, so square miles. Similarly, with census tracts, the smallest census tract is a few acres. The largest is, I think, around 15,000 square miles in Alaska. So, you get these very broad things, but of course we use them. Block groups are the same. And that's a limitation of this kind of data and this kind of analysis, because we really don't have a better way of doing things. And the one to use, of course, really should be based upon your model, but of course you end up using it by what data you have. And you end up with these problems. Sometimes a particular definition may be too narrow, and sometimes it may be too broad. So, and even the same definition in one place might be, vary that way. So you think again about the census tract. If you have, census tracts that are larger than a good chunk of states, and 15,000 square miles versus, say, the 6,000 square miles that's Massachusetts as a whole. How does any measure that's based upon that make any real relevance to data? But of course we do it, because we don't have any alternatives. So these are the kinds of things you can use multi-level modeling to do. And I'm just taking this one particular example. One thing that myself and some colleagues have done is looked at the metropolitan effects of racial residential segregation. Segregation is, on one hand, a horrible, horrible thing that has, I think, warped this country's existence, at least since the end of the 1890s when African-American racial segregation began to rise. On the other hand, it's a great thing to study because it really demonstrates that a lot of the health problems that African-Americans are disproportionately impacted by are not necessarily related to anything related to what African-Americans might share, except for the fact that they have a certain place in society, and therefore they're only allowed to live in certain places. So over time, we've seen that racial residential segregation is associated with exposure to air toxics and air pollution, and you saw that with Asian and Pacific Islanders as well, but African-Americans also and Latino people. I have a poster tomorrow that looks at racial residential segregation and black infant mortality and physical activity. So all of these things, you can see, infant mortality is a measure of general health, but the other two, physical activity and exposure to air toxins, have direct health impacts. And through multi-level modeling, you could actually see that these things actually do have an association. Similarly, people have looked at neighborhood and effects on neighborhood, the characteristics of neighborhood, and they found, for example, that pharmacies and access to prescription drugs are curtailed in certain neighborhoods. One of my colleagues at BU has found that the biggest determinant if a hospital is going to close is if it's in an African-American community. It's not anything else. It's not the percentage of people who don't have insurance. It's not the hospital finances. It's simply where it's located, and it's located in the African-American community. Other people have looked at tobacco advertising, and some colleagues of mine, Rachel Morello-Frosch and Devin and Edwin Srinasa and some others have begun to look at exposure to environmental tobacco smoke, and we find that if you live in a high African-American community, you're more likely to smoke, which is not surprising given the fact you're more likely to be exposed to tobacco advertising. This always brings this question, where are effects happening? There's so many of health impacts in this country, in any place, have a place-based effect. And that's also one of the beauties of multi-level modeling, is that it allows us to begin to understand what are the characteristics of place that drive health. So with that, I ask that you all go out there, do lots of research. Because, you know, on one hand, research is meaningless because we all know that these are truths, that there are underlying disparities in health. On the other hand, we got to make the argument. We got to convince the people who need to be convinced. They're on the fence. And it's harder to deny data. And hopefully it'll be harder to deny data after next Tuesday. So thanks.
Come over here. Sit down.
Okay, we'll take questions now from the audience. Yes, sir.
Jim Lloyd, Cook County Department of Public Health in Illinois. My question for Dr. Wilson is: you're working with community members in Mebane.
Mm-hmm.
Did you work with existing organizations?
Yes.
Or did you seek out people who were not members of existing grassroots power-building organizations? Because sometimes if there's places where a local health department might want to really engage with community partners mm-hmm. in a meaningful way, if there isn't an active group, then, you know, it's kind of... So I was curious about your experience.
So basically every group that I've worked with from North Carolina, South Carolina, and also when I was at my postdoc in Michigan, did some work in Flint and Ypsilanti on food deserts and community gardens. It's basically organizations that already had capacity. They were already organized. You know, so, I mean, that's an important question because maybe in some places where you're going, you're going where you say you're going to places. But what it's good to do, even if you don't have an organization, it's good to find key advocates to work with. You know, and so the key leadership in those communities, whether going to a neighborhood association or going to a church, or going to a sort of, if it's a loose community, finding key advocates would be one way to be able to do community engagement and then to build capacity together through a collaborative process to, you know, address the issue that you're trying to address. But just about 99% of the time, I've worked with organizations that already have capacity, but we're looking for outside experts to come in and help with a particular issue, and we go into this collaborative process. You're welcome. Next question.
Yes. Did you work with a lot of faith-based groups as well, or is that not a... I have an impression that in small areas that would be a very influential partner, but I never saw that.
No, I haven't... well, when I was in Ypsilanti, I worked with a ministerial alliance in Ypsilanti, doing work on sort of all kinds of issues in Ypsilanti. When we're doing work in Graniteville, which I didn't show because I didn't talk about Graniteville, the Graniteville Community Coalition, they had a train derailment, and like I said, it was a chlorine spill, 9 people died, and we're looking at sort of post-secondary surge, looking at the impacts of the what we call secondary surge. We're looking at the impacts, you know, long term. One of the main partners is also we're working with churches, and there's a ministerial alliance because they have some racial issues in Graniteville. And they're trying to overcome that. So you have, you know, your black churches and your white churches, but the pastors are working together. And so they're sort of leading what's going on with those issues in the partnership.
One of the things that I've missed in looking at the program in the last few years is that we've dropped the phrase small area analysis, or what was this, small areas, like in rural
mm-hmm.
North Carolina. Because if you get 100% sample, you don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. Everything you find is real,
mm-hmm.
is true.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to sample. You just need a small community to get the answer from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you can't take that to another community unless
mm-hmm.
they do it too, but it's true for them.
Yeah, that's a good point. Many of the, so what like we're doing with WERA, there are many communities in North Carolina who do not have sewer and water access. The many small communities that are out in the ETJ. So what's going on in Mebane is what you'll find in North Carolina. And you know, so we're that's when the process of trying to get some funding to actually create this institute so we can go across North Carolina, look at these issues, and help train community groups to address the issue. I'm finding the same thing in South Carolina, too. You know, the issues that people don't have sewer and water infrastructure, and then we put the landfill there, or they're going to put something else out there, or they have problems with underground storage tanks or you know, other sort of facilities. So they're different, but you see, that's why when you look at a small area, say, well, you know, I can scale this up to other communities because, you know, you can look at the issues here, 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 and here, and then you look at what Russ is doing in bigger cities, you see more of those things, but you can kind of see what's really going on when you look at sort of that in those settings. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering what legal groups you partnered with to do the complaints and the legal analysis.
So part of what, and I'm going to let this be the last question for me. We need to have other questions for other panelists as well. So if you have other questions for other panelists, let's bring those forward next. Basically, the community partner where they got pro bono legal work. So what it is, if you talk to Omega, he would go into meetings with the town council, and, you know, they would have their engineers, their planners, and their lawyers. He said he used to feel naked going to the meetings. So he said, I need to have my lawyers too. So basically what they did, they partnered with some pro bono law firms. I can't name the firms right, you know, but partnered with pro bono law firms who helped as part of the work group to have a work group that would be able to say, yes, the city would say one thing about, yes, we're in compliance with this law, and the law firm, the law group will be like, no, you're not. We're in compliance with the Civil Rights Act. No, you're not. We follow transactional law properly. No, you haven't. We're in compliance with Title VI. No, you know, so they were able to say, we've done this, and you're like, no, you haven't. And then going through this process of this collaboration sort of mediation process to make sure they were following what they were supposed to follow as well. So questions for Russ or future Dr. Gordon.
So Russ, I have a question.
There you go.
So as you're collecting all your data, you talked about the various limitations. To what extent have you been working with the community groups to help with the collection of the data to help sort of fill in some of those gaps or be able to assess the impacts and exposures?
Well, I think that really important is that this kind of broader analysis is really only one kind of analysis that needs to be done. And I think that you really need multiple strands and multiple rivers of action. So on the one hand, with a national analysis or statewide analysis, you can do wonderful things of showing that there's a national problem of this magnitude, of this nature. And I think that to find the local issues, you need at the same time spending the same amount of resources, if not more, looking at the local factors. And I think that even then, it's great, I think, to pull together kinds of strands. So I think it'd be wonderful, for example, to look at transportation justice in Los Angeles and transportation justice in, let's say, Atlanta and, you know, in building, you know, highways. And, you know, certainly the history of building highways in this country, everybody knows that African-American communities were bulldozed for highways. Mm-hmm. But no one has ever pulled together and said, this is many hundreds of thousands, or this many millions of people were displaced, this many churches were mm-hmm. made to move, this many communities were made to move. So I think you really need to have both. I think you need the local, and you need sort of the national. Yep. And in between.
So your comment, and Nancy made the comment about it's hierarchical but not ordinal, but that sort of talks about linear causality. It's hierarchical, but I don't think it's ordinal. I think there's structural, in an ecological kind of paradigm, there's interactions, but there's also some things that are more fundamentally deterministic than others. So could you just comment about how you build in structural relationships within your hierarchical model?
Well, I think it's not just in building in the model. I think it's also in interpretation. Exactly. So that, because, you know, again, it's like even, you know, some things we know are also certainly a factor in health, but unless you have variation across the country, you're not going to be able to pick it up with these kinds of models. So, for example, let's say hypothetically you had a national administration that didn't want to use, this is hypothetical, that didn't want to use race as a way of analysis for legal issues. Therefore, that affects enforcement in Region 1 and Region 2, all the way up to Region 9 or 10 or whatever there are, right? There's no variation. You have a national exposure across everybody that you know is affecting everybody's legal rights and ultimately their health, but you can't measure in these kind of multi-level models because there's no variation across the country. So I think what really comes is not so much in building the model but the interpretation. Nancy Krieger also talks about being very careful not to say proximate versus distal factors. It's not that being individual or the last thing that hits an individual is the thing that sets off a person's health. It's really a continuum of experiences. It's a continuum of exposures. So that what happens over here and what happens over here are just as important. They both have a great impact. It just may not be immediately apparent where they are.
In the Asians. Pacific Islander arena. I think you said there were 40 different ethnicities that we throw into that figure.
Right.
And working with particularly the larger groups, is there like a comparison of this environmental exposures from before they came to the U.S. and are living in segregated things compared to where they came from?
Well,
literature research was restricted to American experience in this group?
Yes.
And that's what it looked like.
Yes, I did look at Asian Pacific Islander Americans, but some of the literature is beginning to look at the impacts of exposures before immigrating to the U.S. as well as their experience after, but there weren't a whole lot of studies that are out there.
You made a great case for disaggregating data in our communities based on country of origin,
right.
But I'm interested if there's anything in the literature to disaggregate data based on acculturation factors, with the preface being a fourth generation Chinese American in San Francisco is very different than a new immigrant.
Well, some of the data that I've seen are doing that in relation to smoking, because there definitely is a higher prevalence of smoking among Asians who are less acculturated, so, first generation immigrants. So we're beginning to see that in that area.
We have more time. Any additional questions? About 10 good minutes.
Okay, I have a question for you, Shirley. What is the utility on using a new phrase such as pathogenesis versus an older concept, more universal concept such as determinants of health?
Well, for me, what I was trying to do with the ecosystem is understanding the processes and understanding that's a dynamic process of pathogenesis and salutogenesis that go on in every community, and that I wanted to give We talk about pathogenesis a lot in our research. I mean, that's what sort of approach we do a lot, is sort of looking at pathogens, the disease approach a lot. And for me, looking at determinants is important, but I mean, I think the processes, I think as a process and understand the dynamics and then having salutogenesis, there's other terms like health promotion, health prevention, but I think for me, Antonovsky's work is really, really important because he talks about both salutogenesis and pathogenesis and how we really frame how we look at health. And I think it's really important for us to understand that and bring those sort of terms and those processes and how we do research and how we understand how there's been, the communities, specifically communities have been able to be resilient, understanding salutogenesis. So how we can, really get into salutogenesis, not necessarily pathogenesis, how we can understand, take more of a strengths-based approach, an asset-based approach to look at healthy communities and then sort of replicate what's been done and understanding salutogenesis, salutogenesis, pathogenesis, genesis. Understanding that, is really, really important. And I'm trying to take that approach more, that kind of approach, and doing my work. And especially when it relates back to the question for Russ, disillusions, pathogenesis, you're looking at different levels. I'm doing a national study right now where I'm looking at solutions and pathogenesis based on the ecologic distribution, the distribution of ecologic features, both solutions features and pathogenic features. So looking at segregation, looking at supermarkets, looking at landfills, incinerators, exposure to criteria, air pollutants, hazardous air pollutants, and looking at health outcomes, mainly mortality. So I'm doing it at the national level. I'm doing the same thing, looking at CVD, obesity, birth outcomes, stroke, asthma in South Carolina. And now I'm going to another level where I'm looking at bringing that framework into play, working with the Granville Community Coalition and working with the people, Low Country Alliance for Model Communities in Charleston. So I'm doing national, state, and local. So I think it's important to be able to use these concepts. And yes, we understand there are determinants, but understanding salutogenesis is a really, I think, important way to really reframe how we do our research. You know, that's why I think it's important to not just look at determinants, which I'm doing, but understanding salutogenesis. Not necessarily just pathogenesis, but salutogenesis, I think, is really important. It's the point of the framework. Hope to answer your question. That was kind of a circuitous answer. Any other questions?
I have a question. It's kind of based on the organization I come from. I come from a foundation in Orange County, and I also work within a health system. And one of the areas that the foundation is involved with is providing grants for community building.
Mm-hmm.
And I came in later into your, you're already a fourth into your presentation, but I wanted to find out from you if you had any experience in a more metropolitan area where you're looking at building the immobilizing a community that's has a history of difficult relationship with the city that is supporting a business that is having a negative environmental impact on the local community. In particular, it's a waste company that because of the ties they have with city council and the tax that comes from the revenue, or, the tax money that comes to the city, there's sort of an incentive to keep them there versus to push them out because the pollutants through the exhaust and, the smell and the toxicity of having waste around you. And so I wanted to hear a little bit about that if you have any experience but in a metropolitan area.
I've yet to really focus on... I'm doing stuff in Charleston. I mean, it's just, it's not a large metropolitan area, but basically a metropolitan area in Charleston with community groups in Charleston. So that's really my first experience, really, because my CBPR work, community-driven work in North Carolina, besides the working with Omega and the built environment, has been on hog farms. So it's been really rural. So hog farming is a huge issue in North Carolina. But looking at Charleston, so like getting to your point about municipalities, you have to remember, and I think you made this point, municipalities. That's the point. We talk about industries a lot, but the municipalities are the enablers. We talk about pollution-intensive industries, industry, having at least a resistance, boom. Who enables them by giving them tax breaks, by building, giving them, roads, by annexing them, as you saw on the map, we annex you into the city so you can get the sewer and water infrastructure. Without that infrastructure, they can never build there in the first place. So if you taking that model, and actually for your community, for example, and trying to understand those relationships between the municipality and the waste company, I think collaborative problem solving would be one way for the community to come in, sort of build capacity on themselves, and then go to this collaborative problem solving process to address the issue. But in addition to what Omega did and WERA did and MEBIN, they were doing that, but the first thing they did, they submitted a complaint to the Department of Justice to get their attention, to say that we're serious, And Marva may want to say something about that. But submitting that complaint is one way to say, are you in compliance with the Civil Rights Act? Are you compliant with Title VI? Are you in compliance with environmental laws? And if you see they're not in compliance, and they're not doing sort of, one thing about, if you look at federal funding, you get federal funding to do different projects. And you have to have, when you build a facility, for example, in, say, a rural area, you have to get write-off. People have to write to make sure it's not a disproportionate impact. You have to have the Department of Transportation. You have to have the Department of Commerce. You have to have Ag. If they don't make sure it's a disproportionate impact when they're doing a facility development, that's part of transactional law. That means they haven't followed to make sure you got a signature, but you didn't make sure there was a disproportionate impact. If you get that signature like that and there's a disproportionate impact, putting the complaint in can stop because they didn't follow the law. That gets back to understanding the law. So that's something they could do. So put in the complaint. Well, I'm not going to have it. Maybe you can do that. Put in a complaint. That's something to do. And then you can just go through this collaborative problem-solving process at the same time.
I can actually speak to an urban area. The Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative group in Boston.
Come on.
The DS&I group, the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative group, had exactly that problem with a whole bunch of trash transfer stations in their community. And it took maybe 10 or 12 years to get them shut down. Actually, some are still operating, but I think they went from 12. I think there's only two now. And basically, if you're a foundation working with some community groups, fund them for the long term.
Yeah.
It takes a heck of a lot of time. It takes legal. It takes convincing the city. It takes eventually going beyond the city to the state and the feds to look at these kinds of things. It means being relentless until finally these people just give up and, you know, sort of go away. But but in the words of one woman who lived in the community, actually lived right next door to the transfer stations, she goes, "I've been living here all my life. My kids are going to live here. You know, we can start the process today, because even if it's going to take 10 years, who knows, it's going to take more than that. You know, we have all the time in the world. That's the one thing poor people have. They're not going anywhere. So I would just suggest perseverance, and perseverance of funding.
Yeah, real quick, and then this will be the last question.
The National Ramadan Advisory Council did a report on those transfer stations and their policy report. It says a lot of the agencies are facing the same problem you're talking about, and it's on your website at www.ca.gov, and just Google that and get the report. But I also, with the community in West Harlem, New York, Peggy Shepherd is the executive director of the Apple. And they faced the same problem, and they had the same type of things they solved for the waste transfer station in West Harlem, New York. So that's another place to know.
Okay, last question.
So my question is timely. It also has to do with waste transfer stations and some of the challenges we face. I'm in another area in Brooklyn. We have 24 waste transfer stations, and the dominant neighborhoods is zero. Even fewer in Harlem, but it's a tremendous issue. And what the question that I'm asking is outcomes results can be very powerful when you try to convince or appeal to governments that are making changes. You mentioned, we heard twice today that 25% of Americans move regularly. If there's no stability in the communities, how does that affect the outcomes and the power of the outcomes data when you're trying to convince the folks that are going to make the differences, make the decisions?
Good.
Well, on the one hand,
particularly when you're looking at the outcomes on chronic diseases, where it's going to take, you know, sometimes years to see the results.
On the one hand, people move all the time. I mean, on the other hand, people tend to move to similar neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, yes, you have, you know, particularly low-income African American families move a lot because rents are expensive and housing. You know, with the housing crisis we have and everything else. On the other hand, you tend to move from one neighborhood to another neighborhood that's similar. So it's not a lot of differences. And even once you get beyond a certain age, people tend to actually be much more stable in terms of their residential history. Moving is really a younger person's kind of thing to do.
I just want to comment about that, because I've done a lot of work around communities like Superfund sites and ground steel sites. This is something that also ATSDR has done a lot. And over time, one of the biggest problems is that a lot of times when you're working with communities, they'll fall into what I consider to be somewhat of a trap about the health outcomes being such a powerful thing. Because what happens is you end up doing studies that statistically, environmentally, and other ways are generally inconclusive, which are almost invariably interpreted as negative health outcome studies, and it works against them. So I think the issues of looking
exposure,
at
law and exposure,
and power, authority, exposure, pathways, and other approaches are often much more effective. You know, sometimes there are clusters of health outcomes that can be well demonstrated, but that's a really small number.
But what we've said is basically, if it's not good enough for that neighborhood, it's not good enough for this neighborhood either.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean that was a good point, because the thing is we're saying, like, remember, I am in an epi department, but there is an epi trap you can fall into, and it's really a lot of the standards based on an epi standard. And causality, you understand, like getting back to Yolanda's question about the multiple determinants, you have social determinants, you have environmental determinants, you have all kinds of determinants you're exposed to, and those could drive the health outcomes. So yes, you may be exposed to multiple things in the environment, but you know, the cumulative effect, the multiplicative effect, when things interact together, how do you know that those things, all these things, it could be this and could be that? So you don't know, is this chemical? Where's this chemical come from? This industry? Is it coming from three industries? Is it coming from five industries? But you're saying, you're looking at, we have high levels of exposure that increase health risk, and we know there's this infrastructure disparities and lack of compliance. That's the place we need to be more at here, so we won't get trapped in this epi trap. You know. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Fill out the surveys. Give it to Liam. The tall, handsome guy in the back. Hey, how you doing?
Great to see you.
You too.
So, has there ever been that discussion of establishing an environmental justice fig or caucus so that you're not just working through the environment section?
We actually talked yesterday about having an environmental justice group. We have an environmental justice committee, but we said we should be the environmental justice committee for all of APJ. We just said that yesterday.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I want to work with you on that.
Yeah, let me get that. Let me get a clean one. That's another one we got to keep. Okay.
But this is for, because I'm starting with DWEJ,
okay.
Their policy person, so
okay, cool.
I'm actually going to be working in Detroit.
Okay. No, because we have a committee, but we're just saying that we should be the committee for the whole, and we're going to work to have a committee for the whole of APHA. You know, that's smart. And we talk, there's no EJ policies. APHA has no EJ policies in the book. I'm like, and that cuts everything. Yeah, I think we should do that. So I'll shoot you an email. Okay.
And also, if you could send me your paper, okay. Or a copy of those.
Okay, I can send you that. I got like a few of them. I can send them to you. Okay. Thank you. I'm tired, man. He's not here. He's teaching today. Yeah, I'm so tired. I mean, it doesn't seem like it, but I'm running on empty. How are you doing? Hey, I know you. Not well. I know your organization. My friend Malo used to work at Malo Lake.
Oh, great.
At the beginning.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Malo before?
I met Malo. I actually he is a labor.
Yeah, yeah. So Malo, this project I told you for this national project, yeah. Malo's working on the national project.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I thought your presentation was really inspiring and
hope
very
so.
Energetic.
I'm so sorry.
Very energizing. And I wanted to let you know, on Policy Lake, we have a center for health and place, and we're working on their behavioral related and technical assistance
okay.
In built environment and health. Mm-hmm. And I heard you say that you guys are going to expand your technology.
We're trying to build an institute. It'll be a virtual institute. A nationwide virtual institute. And so it would be great. We need to talk because I was trying to get my lips are peeling. See, I talk so much with my chapstick in. He had lip peeling in front of me. I dried my lips out. Yeah, but no, we need. We were trying to get to the conference in New Orleans. We weren't able to go.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, and I tell people for this institute, one of the models would be policy lens.
Yeah. And we're definitely, we just got funding to expand our
So, do you think we could have like a conference call or something?
For sure.
Malo knows everybody. So, and what's the guy's name? Because we actually submitted a paper that I think what's the guy? Not Manuel. What's his, but with Policy Link, what's your?
Which guy?
The second in charge or the third in charge?
Victor Ruiz.
Yeah, Victor.
Yeah.
We submitted a paper together for Victor was doing guest editor for community development.
Yeah.
Yeah, we submitted a paper to that, and I talk about where and that, and also Malo talks about some stuff in Boston, some other places.
Yeah.
So he knows everybody, so we should definitely do that.
Yeah. Do you have a Victor Carter?
Actually, I ran out.
You ran out. Okay. So,
but what I can do, yeah.
Is it okay to use computer? You're using it?
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
If you want to contact me.
Okay.